My name is Eric Swenson. This is the session that's called Care for Creation Center a little deeper. I don't think but a few people were here for the first, you were here for the first session. So I'm going to repeat some stuff. Okay? Not a whole lot because I never do the session twice the same anyway. But where this session would be a little bit different is when I do a two-part session. The first one is I sort of introduce everyone to the whole concept of what would that be, you know, on making your congregation a creation awareness center. And then we would talk about that, and I'd introduce some materials after talking about, you know, what that means and what it would mean for you to get in this process. And this session would be more in-depth, action-oriented. But I think that what I'll do is combine the two or something. I don't know. We'll see. It's meant to be free-flowing, a lively discussion, participatory. And if I have to cut you off, please don't take it personal. It just means that I don't want to. I think it'd be best if we go back in this direction or whatever. Now, let's look at this sheet. This will be a good way of kind of catching up, you know, on what the idea means, Church's Creation Awareness Center. And then you can take it and you can read more later. Basically, what I'm saying, to distill it, is that I think we're called certainly, you know, we're called by God to live out our faith. And I think something that we've neglected, along with the rest of Western culture, indeed the whole planet seems to have been going this way in this century, is living very self-centered lives as far as consuming resources, not caring so much about what is left for other people. And a lot of that is simply our mindset, our worldview, that, certainly the resources are endless. You know, why worry about cutting down trees? Trees grow, you know, and we'd certainly never, you know, cut down all the trees in North America. I mean, that's ridiculous. But as we see it, well, actually we did. they started cutting down trees when they landed in Plymouth, and they've been working their way across the country. And all of a sudden, we've got a huge problem in Oregon because we're having all these layoffs because we're running out of trees. Because we've gotten down to where there's so many trees, and then all of a sudden people are screaming, oh, wait a minute, you know, we're losing all our wildlife because we've chased them into these smaller areas, and now we're going into these areas, and the animals don't have a place to go. The thing with the spotted owl is that our best scientific knowledge says that a pair, in order to mate, need a couple square miles. Well, it turns out that, you know, you start to go, well, where do they live? You go, well, there's not that many places where they can even be. Now, they might find out that, you know, maybe they can live in other places. But an old-growth forest is drastically different than anything else. An old-growth forest has a pretty stable temperature and not much wind goes through it. But if you go in and clear-cut a section, all of a sudden you've got, you know, temperature extremes and a lot of wind. And there's a phenomenon called blowdown. They'll go in and they'll clear-cut 40 acres, and then the next acre, trees get knocked over because they grew and lived the first couple hundred years of their life with very little wind. All of a sudden, they're faced with 40, 50 mile an hour winds. I'm getting off the subject. That is one of the things, though, that in Oregon is a real issue for us. And there's something I want people to understand. When I talk about care for creation, I'm talking for caring for people, too. You know, I'm not, we have to be real careful how we talk. You know, that maybe the best thing for the animals and the trees would be to leave them alone. But it's not good to put 70,000 timber families in trouble. You can't. It's complicated. And that's another thing, is we will get into talking about some environmental actions and stuff. And these discussions typically always go, yeah, but I heard this. And someone says, but I heard this. And then the third person says, well, I'm not going to do anything. You know, if it's that complicated, and we'll never know. And then someone else says, well, you know, what one person does doesn't make a difference anyway. You know, and that's not it at all. We've got plenty of clear-cut choices in which way we want to go. And now we're having more scientists and more work is being done on the environment than ever before, and new knowledge is coming out. So it's good to read a lot and keep up with it, you know, and we'll find out in a couple of years that, well, maybe that wasn't the best thing to do as far as solid waste. Mm-hmm. What we should be doing is this. But I think right now is sort of a pivotal time. And that's why it's very important for you as individuals and for your congregations to get in on this. It's, I think that you have, I think being having your church being a creation awareness center is a good evangelism tool. It's a good sign of health. And I think when people come and visit you and they see that you make this big to-do of your friendliness and you invite them to stay for coffee, and then you hand an environmentalist a cup of coffee and a styrofoam cup, you think you're doing something very wonderful and friendly, and you're having hospitality, and that person is going, oh God, what do I do? What do I do? I refuse to buy styrofoam. Now this person's giving this to me. You know, and they're making this ethical choice, and you know, they may not be back. There's all kinds of things. Back to this sheet, you know, basically what I say is that one of the basic things of us as a church is us as a worship center. We're a worshiping community. That's probably our primary function, and I think out of that everything else comes. Out of our worship and our education is where our actions come from. So, being a creation awareness center is just be sort of the way you hold up the hymns that you sing, the word that is preached, and the prayers. When I'm assistant minister, I when I'm doing the prayers of the church, I say, let us pray for all creation and for all creatures according to their needs, instead of saying, let us pray for the people of God in Jesus Christ and for all people according to their needs. I've thought about this, and I don't want to just pray for Christians. If one of our petitions that follows that is for all the people that have been dispossessed by a cyclone in Bangladesh, well, that isn't what we said we were going to pray about, because not very many of those people probably are Christians. And I'm not going to just pray for just the Christians. And I'm not just going to pray for just people, because I'm very concerned about that. In the very first paragraph, we talk about the covenant with Noah. And then that covenant specifically talks about that we're, God is telling us this, and he says, I am making this covenant with you. And included in this covenant are all the birds, all the animals, and the earth itself. So I'm bound up in this. And this is, you know, you'll hear people talk about the interrelatedness of all life. You know, well, here it is explicitly stated, very ancient understanding. It's interesting for me to find that you hear about, has anyone here ever heard of the Gaia theory? Okay, the Gaia is just the Greek word for Earth. And, well, it's a female divinity of Mother Earth. But the Gaia theory basically is that the Earth is one living organism. And that, we say we're part of it, and that Mother Earth sustains us. Well, this is it. It's saying that we're actually, you know, we're one organism. We're just part of that. And that it's real interesting. The Jesuit biologist and scholar, philosopher, Teilhard de Chardin, talks about that maybe what we are is, since we're the only creatures that seem to be able to have conscious thought and speech, that perhaps the part of the universe that we are the thinking creatures that are meant to speak up for the earth, and that maybe the earth communicates its thoughts to us. And so maybe what is going on now, where you have a group of human beings telling the other human beings, you know, stop killing the earth, that we're just, you know, the people that are doing that are just, you know, playing out their function.
You just thought of something here. Maybe the earth is a living thing and we are just considered sort of little invading bacterium before all of going to shake us off and go on about our business.
Well, that could happen. I mean, that's the way it's going. You know, you see t-shirts and everything that says save the earth. You know, let's be honest about what we're saying. Let's save a human sustaining earth. Because there's very little that we could do to actually get rid of the earth. I mean, even if we cracked it in half, there would still be two earths going around. You know, but what is real likely is what World Watch Institute, the people that put out the State of the World book, tell us is that we've got 40 years to turn it around. Otherwise, it's going to be downhill. We won't be able to restore. And that the earth will no longer sustain human life. So a Lutheran theologian named Larry Rasmussen teaches at Union Theological Seminary in New York. I heard him speak. And he said that the way things are going, the earth is going to be the cross that the human race is crucified upon. And you might have also heard the idea that what we're doing is we're going to boil in a toxic pollution stew. Dr. Gerald Barney is a Lutheran who led the writing of the President's Global 2000 report. It was prepared under the direction of Jimmy Carter. Problem was, this, by the time they got it done, Ronald Reagan was in office. And Ronald Reagan put it on the shelf because it definitely didn't square with his worldview. Because the President's 2000 report said, slow down. We're consuming the world's resources. We're not replenishing. And Ronald Reagan and his form of capitalism more or less says, you know, you just go on, you get bigger, it gets better. And that's now a lot of economists are even debating whether or not that's even a feature of capitalism that is necessary, that you have to expand.
And this 40-year period of time that this doctor was talking about, that doesn't include a nuclear holocaust,
no.
Does it?
No, and that's what is sort of interesting. What we're looking at is a scenario sort of like a nuclear holocaust. You know, what we've been concerned about during my lifetime, you know, the threat of nuclear war, we've been sort of focused on that. But the real evil has been our lifestyles, our simple lifestyles. I was telling group, you know, yesterday that, you know, I grew up with, if you were a little cold in the winter, you went over to the thermostat and you jacked it up a couple degrees. This was a new idea that you would put on a sweater if you were cold, you know. And if I did anything, I would go put on a sweater and turn up the thermostat. okay, now what I want to get back to, this is sort of groundwork on, you know, what the problem is, now what's the solution. And the solution is that we educate ourselves and others. That I see it as sort of the basic Christian gospel, you know, we are to be a light to the world. And it does make a difference what our actions are. It really does make a difference what our actions are. Not that, you know, we're going to get our salvation and how good of environmentalists we are. That's not the question at all. But what the question is that, let me read what David Brower was one of the leaders of the Sierra Club, and he left that to start his own group, Earth Island Institute, and he has a videotape out that you can get. It's a 30-minute videotape, and in it he says that, let me read a little bit here. Environmental problems are as serious as anything that we have to confront on this earth. Anyone who is observing what is going on outdoors can see what is happening to the air, the water, the soil, and what we are doing with our technology, our overconsumption, our thoughtlessness about the future and the earth. We cannot have peace on earth unless we make peace with the earth. This is going to require every sector of human society, and it will particularly require the best organized sector of human society, the church. Now, if you think about this, anytime any group of individuals in this country wants to organize and fight some social evil that they see, they have to invent the wheel. They have to do all kinds of legwork just to get people together. We as the church come together at least once a week. If you're on a lot of committees and stuff, you go to the church quite a few times a week. So we already have a group that already meets regularly. We should already be as a family, knowing and caring what the others do and what kind of lives that they have, that they have the good things that they need to, the basic requirements of life. And one of the good things that we need is that we are about doing God's business and living right. I see it as the kind of modeling that goes on in our church and in our coffee hours and our potlucks and our church dinners. The way we handle, our waste from those things should be modeling to our young people, to ourselves, and to our visitors, just what kind of lives we lead. You can look at this sheet later. I talk about some of the specific actions that we did at Augustana, and these are just a couple of them. But I was real glad when I got there that they had, a few months previously, through the council, passed a resolution that not only would they not use styrofoam, but not let any of the groups that meet in our facility, some like 20 neighborhood groups, we use our facilities, they should not use styrofoam either. And basically all, what they did was get out the ceramic mugs. Because it was just a matter of convenience is the only reason that we've gone to disposable cups. Most of us own the cups. All we have to do is wash them. Now the way we handled it in our congregation was just people that would bring cookies. We had someone who organized who was going to bring the cookies for forum and coffee hour, and we just asked that they contact those people and see if they wouldn't mind staying an extra 10 minutes and running a couple loads of cups through the dishwasher. It's no problem. And it's like, well, why didn't we do this all the time? A lot of people will just go, we've been spending a lot of money on those cups. So for a lot of good reasons, that's one thing. People, it's a positive step when they go from styrofoam to paper cups. But paper cups are extremely wasteful, extremely expensive, and they don't biodegrade. They're not very well anyway. They're coated with wax or clay resins in order to be water resistant, and that's what they do. You throw them away and they're in the landfill and they continue to be water resistant. Okay. Can we look on and share this reduce, reuse, recycle? You've already seen it. Let's see what we've got here. Maybe you two could sit together. I've got one more.
Question? How resistant have you, or how much resistance have you had in your own congregation to these ideas? Is 100% of congregation
not much.
It's easy.
Yeah. What it is and a step I don't want to skip is in the educational process. I see that as maybe two different things. One is what you do through Sunday school, including Sunday forum, and another thing is to try to start a small group in your congregation. And that's very easy to do. Go to the pastor, and say, who do you know that seems to be concerned about the environment? And then start talking and trying to get together on a good time. We chose Monday evenings at 7 o'clock. Only meeting once a month, be careful not to burn people out. But
what I thought was real interesting was the people that we had come the first night was the head usher, the president of the congregation, one of the most active young mothers, one of the most active senior citizens. These were people who already did quite a lot for the church, because that was just part of acting out their faith, was that they cared very much about what happened in the structure itself. And so you, that was one of the reasons probably that it was easy for our congregation to do things, was because it was the leaders of the congregation and the group itself. But I don't think that was unusual, for this congregation. Now, it's out of the discussions that small group had that the actions came. So it wasn't like one of the staff saying, let's do this. I think it's a lot safer, a lot more practical, what happens in that group discussion, reaching a group consensus on an action to do. And part of the value of that is the education that happens, and while you're discussing, why don't we do this? There are some things that are more practical and easy to do, and it might be wisest to do things that everyone can see. Well, I don't see why we don't do that. Let's do that, and see and get the trend going that way, and then you can maybe face some tough questions later. But basically, most of the things that can be done and need to be done in congregations aren't tough questions like you might make in your own personal life. I heard a speaker last year talk about if you were going to get into deep ecology. Now, have you heard the expression deep ecology? I mean, that's basically just deep versus shallow. That you're really going to do something. You're going to make lifestyle changes that radically affect your life. And he was talking about the four greatest ones that you could do. And then one of them, obviously, I have such a problem with that I've blocked it out of my memory because I can't remember what the fourth one is. But now these are radical changes. One would be that you would give up an automobile until automobiles are not so devastating to our planet, because they are. One of the most harmful things you can do is drive to work on the planet. With global warming, with using up resources, we've seen how we went to war and killed 100, 200,000 people because our source of oil was even threatened, just because there was a perceived threat. That's my slant on that.
You're right.
I think so. I think it's amazing how you can make statements like that and people might just kind of look down. You won't hear anyone say, "No, wait a minute. We didn't mean to kill anybody." Or whatever. I think it's a real sad commentary on our society that we just accept that. And actually feel pretty good about it. Because if we had shame, I heard Reverend William Sloan Coffin talk a couple months ago, and he was talking about what he thought was going to happen was just a huge wave of shame was going to come across our country, and we would have a moral reawakening out of that. But that hasn't happened. If that was happening, George Bush wouldn't be the most popular president in recent history. Some Democrats would be going out there and rattling some sabers, but as it is, we have no one. I guess you see what party I belong to. There's no one who wants to run against George Bush, because if you look at the people that have run against the Republicans lately, Walter Mondale, who's he? Michael Dukakis, who's he? They ended in political death. All their national goals and aspirations were dashed once they were creamed in the election.
Good.
Yeah, everyone can just jump in any time. It's supposed to be a discussion.
You're talking about this war over oil, which I don't disagree with you a bit. But how many people who are condemning this war would be willing to face the change in lifestyle that they would have to if Saddam Hussein controlled all the oil in the Middle East? Now, no, be honest. I mean, I'm trying to be objective.
Well,
you talk about giving up your automobile, you don't know better you would because you couldn't afford to run it.
Right. And see, I personally believe that gasoline should cost at least $3 a gallon.
That would be a down payment on it if he controlled the oil.
Okay.
Because I'm sure it would go much higher than that.
But, see, first of all, I don't think Saddam Hussein was ever going to control very much oil.
Then you're dreaming.
Well, how is that going to happen? He was going to control the traffic and the Gulf?
He was going after Saudi Arabia next.
I'd like to back up to the original question, and the original question kind of was proposed that how many people would
give up the car?
Give up cars, and
right.
That is the answer to
it. I don't mean one in three, I mean all three of them.
Yeah, the same number of people that are giving up cars for the environment right now.
Yeah.
Practically no one.
Well, the traffic in big cities, and you know, to get more than one person in a car, it's just a failure. People
want
to
go left. Yeah. And not on the roads as well.
Yeah. It's a whole Western, mm-hmm. whole Western system.
I mean,
Germany, France, you know, it's a whole Western democracy, or what we would term it as, which is the same blood process.
But we've got a uniquely American situation with the automobile. I mean, this is how we move our workforce. You know, in Europe, most people take public transportation to work. They're mainly their daily commute. Now you have situations like that are just ridiculous, like Oklahoma City and Los Angeles and other places, where half the land in the metropolis is given over to the use of automobiles. Between parking and highways, half the land in Los Angeles is given over to automobiles.
I don't think Los Angeles has a public transportation system.
But they're building one.
Are they?
My sister lived in that area, but she said what is so it's almost like a boondoggle because they're going to build a subway.
Mm-hmm.
But if
from nowhere to where?
Yeah. I mean, it's so spread out.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm from New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk about it. You want to talk about recycling, waste, toxic waste, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But in New Jersey, in the metropolitan area, you can literally move large, and they do, because they have to,
mm-hmm.
move large groups of area of people to a central area. In Los Angeles, where are you going to move them to?
Yeah.
You know, we're in Washington, D.C., which has a wonderful system right now, moving people from the suburb in because there's a central mm-hmm. hub. But in Los Angeles, there's no central hub.
If gasoline goes to $3 a gallon, you'd see people moving back into the city pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
The suburb is a unique American phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
Try $6 a gallon, or either 10 or 12.
I was in Ireland during one of our oil crisis periods, which was worldwide,
mm-hmm.
and I was taking public transportation. And when the people on the bus found out I was an American, they turned around and backed me into a corner to lecture me on Americans' use of our resources.
Yeah.
And of course, in Ireland at that time, I think it was around $3-4 a gallon. And in Europe and every place, but I mean, at this time they were queuing up. They were leaving their cars for like 2-3 days at a time in long lines
mm-hmm.
and just leave them there. And then when once a week or twice a week they would open up these gas pumps, their little cars would be in line already. Were viewed as a wasteful.
Yeah, which is the way it is.
Mm-hmm. I was going to talk about the cups. I belong to a mission congregation.
Mm-hmm.
We're just looking for the all these neat ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And, for our coffee hour, we use ceramic cups until someone said, "Had you ever considered the fact that using the dishwasher where I live uses up so much electricity that you've got to, you know, where are you getting ahead
mm-hmm.
here? The landfill, which we have none of, or the electricity,
mm-hmm.
which is very expensive
mm-hmm.
and at a minimum the east. So, you know, you want to talk about something.
So what'd you do?
We use ceramic.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody takes their cup, brings their cup from home.
Mm-hmm.
Because we figured, of course, when you've got about 100 people, you can do this. We figured everybody is going to do it at home, so right. Just stick another couple cups in.
Right. A good thing to do is have a mug tree.
Mm-hmm. And we just got rid of ours because it was just so disgusting. People were using other people. Can I go and use my cup? And somebody else had used it, not washed it out. Everything's growing in those cups.
Yeah, you have to rinse out coffee. Coffee's fertile.
Our council is just kind
of empty. And maybe it's because I live in a state that has had to become extremely aware of these issues. You can't go anyplace where people are not speaking about the environment, about the usage of our resources. I don't care what meeting you go to, I don't care where you go, people are really, really aware of this.
I think that the thing that's just wonderful is, and I think you've mentioned it before, I'm aware, but I heard you mention is kids. You know, kids are hearing about recycling in school. My daughter's in preschool, and they took her to the recycling bins and everything. And I work with high school kids, and I'm on a backpacking trip. When I was a kid, I mean, anything that would burn, we put in the fire and get rid of it so we didn't have to haul it out. Mm-hmm. You know, we hauled out a big bag full of plastic because they wouldn't let me burn it. You know, mm-hmm. I think that's great.
Yeah.
I think it's great how we're educating kids.
Before I forget, I want to talk about this. Last year, while I was an intern in Portland, I got a telephone call from this woman who was at a parish out in the suburbs, and she wanted to talk about what the idea that her kids had come up with. She, as a youth leader, uses the model of a facilitator, and they always plan out what they're going to be doing the next coming year and then the next month, and I'm going, now exactly what are we going to do this next month? And a lot of the kids wanted to do something. Since Earth Day was coming up in April, they wanted to do something, and so they started talking about it, and they said, well, let's make the whole month an environmental month, and let's really do something to focus the congregation's attention on this. And they said, well, what can we do? They decided that they would do the worship services for the month, and that they so what they did was they printed up this worship folder. It's the whole service, and they started off with the opening hymn, Earth and All Stars, and then they have a confession and forgiveness that concerns our sins against creation, and then they have a liturgy here with they call it Partnership for Healing, and then they sing praise and thanksgiving, and then the prayer of the day is from St. Patrick, a creation awareness prayer. Celtic spirituality their whole theology was all tied up in what their relationship was with the rest of the world. They started off the month with this service. And they had, and they said, well, what else can we do? And they came up with, they had an Earth Expo. And they led after this service, they led the congregation to a neighboring park and had a cleanup. And then they printed up this Earth Expo, Caring for God's Creation, 99 Ways You Can Care for Creation. So they made up their own list. And then last June, she was a part of the group that did a workshop at our Synod Assembly, and this is the page that we put together a package of materials for everyone, and these are all the different things that they did. The worship service, they distributed creation pledges, they set up a resource table, they did the park cleanup, they set up a recycling program at the church with putting boxes for different types of paper in all the offices. They taught. The youth sought out and made available resources to the Sunday school teachers, preschool staff, and adult education committee regarding teaching the value and specifics of recycling. These resources will be permanently available in the church's youth room. They decided, I can't believe how intelligent this group was. They said, we will go to each group in the church and present our ideas. How few people in the church would even think about doing that, or go to that much work to meet with each committee? And then spreading the word and ongoing activities. It's just a really great group of people there. But this is the kind of thing that is I don't know. To me, it shows a healthy congregation that they can empower their kids in such a way, and that they're, you know, working with them, that they're open, and I just think it's a great group of people, and I don't think that's anything that can't be done anywhere. I mean, if you have youth.
How many copies of that service do you have?
And just this one. But you can look at it.
Is there a copy machine up here?
Yeah, there's a copy machine, but we kind of guard it. If we don't try to use it, we try not to use it too much because, you know, if that copy machine breaks down, we have to import a repair person. You know, and you talk about a service call charge. You know, I mean, they're giving you a day because they got to spend the night.
Do you have a list of volunteers?
That would be a good idea.
Yeah.
I don't think we have too many of them, though.
Is it appropriate to bring up another part of ecology?
Sure.
Okay, we're deep well irrigators for Wick Farm.
Mm-hmm.
And
you call it deep well givers?
Deep well irrigators.
Deep well irrigators, oh.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
That used to be all dry land. And this
yeah.
is in Odessa, which is a little community in eastern Washington. And then no one had any idea that irrigating that land would produce, you know, how many fold more.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember the first year we married, I think it was 17 bushels an acre, and eventually we drilled a deep well. Well, now there's a really strong concern about our water table's going way down.
Yeah.
And so one of our wells isn't even functional anymore, and so we drilled a new one last summer, which is so costly, it's just... And we had to go down to 1,343 feet before we hit any water.
Wow.
And so, and the well driller, you know, had some stones that he gave us and showed us. They smelled like sulfur. I mean, they were he said, at least a million years old. Anyway, the concern is, okay, we you know, the price of wheat is not good, so we need to continue to irrigate. After you put all that money into irrigation equipment, you can't afford just to go back to dry land. And yet, you know, eventually what's going to happen? You know, they talk some about maybe, well, for instance, we have a permit. We can only pump 2,600 gallons a minute, which is a lot of water, but it's a big farm. And it's a family farm, so there are a lot of families living off the same farm. But like, at what point, you know, do you stop using that water up?
Yeah.
Stop using it when the oil runs dry.
Well,
probably,
I mean...
Because you can't afford not to use it.
Right. You're caught in the total dilemma. There's two basic processes in the universe. There are termed feed forward and feed back. And
well,
you're caught in the feed forward system.
Well, and one of the things that, you know, I don't do anything about it. I just think about it and talk about it. But, okay, we were promised the East High Canal that would have come from Cooley Dam.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would get our water from there. We wouldn't have had to deep
mm-hmm.
irrigated well. It never happened. It was promised to us probably 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot has happened in the last 30 years. You know, I don't know very much about that whole process, but I know that, I'm originally from Kansas, and we've got the Ogallala Aquifer there, and it basically runs from Kansas down to Texas, and it's running dry, and, you know, we're just going to, there's going to, I think farming's going to have to change. I think that maybe irrigation has seen its day. As far as, you know, we're in a different watershed there and everything than when you start talking about the western United States with that. I mean, so much of the western United States is the population centers and the farms are off of one river, the Colorado River.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's sort of insane the way that we've gone. We've marched towards progress with a blind eye towards the implications of, you know, how you were setting your hope on one thing there, to that Phoenix continues to be going through a boom in population, and I just don't understand. I don't understand you know, how Southern California.
But it isn't just confined here. Mexico City, on through South America, it's urbanization, the movement and transfer of poor is happening worldwide, and the living, I mean, Mexico City is the most populous city in the world, but it just, it's going on. It's the same thing where there's 50% of the people required to make the food, now there's three. Mm-hmm. It's happening worldwide.
But as to this situation, we put people completely across in areas that were not meant for people. And, I mean, I'm from Nebraska, the Ogallala Aquifer goes to South Dakota.
It runs all the way.
The whole, you know.
And isn't it in trouble? I mean.
Oh, absolutely.
Very deep. Yeah.
Well, you know, the government, when they, excuse me, go ahead.
No, but don't you feel that, I mean, I took the train here, and I can tell you how much of the country is irrigated. And a lot of the country that's irrigated is desert.
Yeah. Oh, yes, we're told desert.
And I know we need the food, so, I mean, you know, this is one of those little ethical dilemma type of things, but we've certainly put people where people shouldn't. We're never meant to be. Mm-hmm.
Well, in 1900, my husband's grandfather came over, so my sons are the fourth generation farmers. And he was given 160 acres. The government just was giving those away if they homestead them. And, you know, clear the sagebrush, clear the rocks. But the history of that, my husband has told me that he's read several places, the government never expected those German people to make it, Russian-German people. they wanted them to clear it, but they didn't think they could sustain their livelihood. And they made it. Mm-hmm. They were tough.
That's a testament to the human spirit.
Mm-hmm. And they lived in caves the first winter they came. You know, they'd hollow out these places that, mm-hmm. you know, it's desert, but they'd hollow out a place to live. And only the strong survived. And so the government was responsible for that land becoming farmland. Mm-hmm. And a blessing in a way to these immigrants that wanted to come to the United States. But you're right, it was desert. Mm-hmm. Still is. Now, if you can't grow a tree where I live unless you have a lot of water to give it every day.
Yeah, and you know, the other part of the whole water situation there, I saw a show about a year ago on how some of the Indians are actually getting their water rights that are in the treaty. And so they have, now the control over a lot of water has changed hands. And what that's going to mean.
And the fishing rights and so on. So debatable.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't see where we got a leg to stand on in so many of these issues with the Native Americans. I mean, if we got a treaty, how can we say we're not going to obey it and still have respect for the law? And still, I mean, this is the government. It's still the same government that wrote the treaties. We haven't changed hands.
When the government has almost complete control of farms now, I think the first year we were married, we could plant fence to fence. After that, we were married 38 years. After that, there was an allotment that we couldn't plant. Now we're paid quite well for not planting anything.
Yeah.
And yet the world's starting. I mean,
yeah, that's amazing.
Has anybody ever figured out that X number of people is the maximum amount of people that this earth can sustain?
Sure.
Well, what is the figure? Of course, it would depend on who did the figure.
Yeah, right.
Distributed.
Yeah. But, I mean, just to talk in real general terms, because that's all that is that, you know, we'll hit that in 10 or 20 years.
What do they think the figure is?
Oh,
7 billion?
I think something like 7. You know, there's, as it is now, you know, hunger is a justice issue. It's not a scientific or there's not a finite level or anything. It's a justice issue. Food is
well, food isn't the only factor.
It's the economics of it. Economics determine, you know, how people eat and what they will eat.
Well,
you know, one of the major problems in the world is the countries that are starving, third world countries, where so many of the hungry are, all have huge foreign debts. And they spend so much of their resources to pay interest on loans that they probably shouldn't have ever had in the first place. That a lot of these loans were made by, the money came from oil suddenly oil-rich banks that the OPEC nations were putting their money into. And a lot of these loans were made, a lot of it comes from the World Bank, which we are, the United States basically is the World Bank. It's United States corporations and American politicians have traditionally been appointed to its ruling board. And it's those people who made these loans. You know, a real serious matter is talking about loan forgiveness. You know,
so forget about politics, just simply the mechanics of it. If the whole world were a communistic organization and everything was distributed evenly and what have you, food isn't your only problem. I mean, you've got
water.
Well, not only water, but you've got the waste that all this population is going to create.
Yeah.
I just wonder what is the maximum and what's going to happen when we cross that? Because obviously we will.
I mean, this is what, in our lifetime, this is going to become a real faith issue.
And
you know, so how do you deal with other people?
This was the issue, you know, that, and I can't think of the name of the country that suffered the last big typhoon, hurricane type thing. They were living on areas that they were not on the floodplain because they had no place else to live.
Right. And you know why it floods so much now? Because they've denuded the hillsides looking for firewood just to cook their meals. That's a big problem in a lot of third world countries. Is for here, you know, we're cutting down trees so we can have cedar shakes on our ranch homes. But, you know, in other places, they're just trying to get firewood. And most people, because all they're set up for is to have a fire in the middle of their hut. You know, there's appropriate technology people. I went and visited this group in Oregon. That they've come up with these stoves that can be made with about $2 worth of supply. This one is called a downfeed downdraft stove, where you basically, like, it looks like a J, and you stick a twig, you start a fire with a twig in the bottom of the J, and you would cook on the top of the J, and it would be hot enough to cook on within 30 seconds, and it just burns one piece of wood at a time and just burns the tip down, so when the one piece of wood disappears, you put in another. That kind of stuff, to make that distributed to people around the world, save so much. And another thing they do is to make a solar oven with $2 worth of parts. You know, basically takes aluminum foil and a piece of glass and a box to put it in. There's a lot of things we can be doing. Go ahead.
What were the other two deep ecology things?
Oh, yeah. Okay, the deep ecology things are, of course, the one would be to give up your car. The other thing would be to quit eating meat. I mean, we got a sheet here, you know, why you should eat. Al Pitcher wrote some of these things. He was the village philosopher scholar here for 20 months, and he became vegetarian when he came here. He ate meat until it was shown to him. You know, if you read a book like A Diet for a New America, you'll see that, I mean, basically, it takes about 20 times as much resources to have a diet like we're used to with a lot of meat versus a total vegetarian diet. It's the amount of water and grain that go into a pound of hamburger. It's just astounding. 2,000 gallons of water for a pound of hamburger. It's the water in the raising and the production of the meat and everything. Okay, so you give up your car, you quit eating meat, you don't have any more children. Now that's a hard one. Well, yeah, for some people, you can do all three, no problem. I mean, that's one where you start going, wow.
Yeah, that's real touchy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
and now part of
not only that, but the,
and you don't remember the poor.
I can't remember the
poor. Poorest countries, of course, mm-hmm. are growing at the fastest.
But the problem there is that Indira Gandhi, when she was still alive and president of India, was invited to speak to an environmental conference, Rulers of Nations, and she just leveled everyone, saying, you know, you guys keep coming at us with our overpopulation. She goes, but one person in your country uses up as much resources as five people in our country. So if we have 400 million people and you have 200 million people, you know, you're using up the resources of a million of ours, so we can go, you know, we can do whatever we want to. I mean, that is a big thing, you know, because, I mean, 25% of the households in this country are single person households. Not 25% of our people live by themselves, but 25% of those houses. Now that's unthinkable in most countries. You know, you're going to have whole families, maybe three generations, you know, 12, 20 people in the same house. Whereas, you know, I live alone. I like living alone.
Are you to be faulted for that? It's here. If you didn't do it, what would happen to the resources that you consume?
Yeah, I know. And
is that rationalization?
No, I mean,
on my part.
You know. I live in different situations. You know, I mean, I had an intern house where I was before, and that was set aside for the intern. But I lived very frugally there and tried to be as environmentally sound as I could. And basically, I mean, I turned off the heater every night, and I turned it up when I got up, and then turned it off, and it was off for the rest of the day until I came home at night. And I found that it was very easy for me to... I only produced one garbage sack, one paper grocery sack of garbage per month, and then I just take that in and put it in the dumpster at church. I'm just doing that by, I mainly do eat produce, and I compost, you know, the ends of that, and I buy bulk, so I'm not throwing away a lot of bottles and stuff, and I buy very little pop. You know, I think pop is kind of foolish.
Number four was probably moving with five other households in the same household or something.
It was something more radical than that. It's something so intense I couldn't think about it. But, I mean, I invite y'all to live where I do. You know, it's just, you know, where we live in the ambiguities of life. We live in the tension. We know we can do this, we can do that. There are some clear-cut choices and for everyone. And then there's clear-cut choices for people that feel the same way you do. And then there's a lot of things that you go, well, this or that. You know, someone hands, if I go to a conference somewhere and all they've got is styrofoam cups, I stop and I think about it and go, do I really want a cup of coffee? If I really want a cup of coffee, I'll go ahead and have it. I'm not hard and fast, you know. I try to stay flexible in my decisions, and knowing that, you know, throughout each day I make hundreds of decisions that impact the environment. You know, I think that a real good way of understanding is everything your hands touch throughout the day, you are responsible for.
If you see that the nation doesn't really turn itself around in this next decade, what's your step as an individual? Move to Canada?
No. I'm a Lutheran. I'm a Lutheran. I'm called to be a member of the church that is a reforming body in the church, Catholic. I don't see that I have a choice to move to a Polynesian island or something like that. You know, I like being a Lutheran. I like living there somewhere, you know, and that, you know, our theology is awfully close to the Roman Catholics, but we're sure not Roman Catholics, are we? You know, I mean, over here the Baptists, you know, and, well, I'm not a Baptist either, you know. We're to continually, you know, if you're a Lutheran, you know, you're talking about justification by grace through faith and faith active in love and things like that. I'm around the village. You just come up to me and we'll talk about this stuff. What's that?
That's dinner.
That's dinner. First dinner.
Thank you.
No. Not until tonight.
Yeah, I'm going to leave this right here. If anyone wants to look at it. And then later, stuff will be in the resource center.
Okay.
These booklets here are five. I didn't say anything. These are $5. And these are $2. Yeah, resource centers, you go down this hall and it's the first door on your left.
Okay, thank you.
Okay?
Look, it's $5. Let me go get some money.
Okay.
What's he doing?
You can just put it in your cup.
Okay?
You're another self today? No, I'm going to have a creation awareness Bible study tomorrow. So we're going to look at all.
Which one is that? Mark,
it is the board.
It's at the board. But we'll be looking at all the major texts and how they sort of affect. That's really good.
I'll take that. That's for this one.
Right.
This is a good one, too.
Yeah, this $2. That's good because now what this is a report by the Presbyterians that was adopted last year.
Now, they do a big report every year. This year, human sexuality, they sent it back to the committee. More work. This is good for, like, the first 33 pages are just a real good sort of faith-based understanding of what our major environmental problems are, and a good way of looking at it. And then in the very back, the appendices, there's appendix number two has good statements. Some World Council of Churches and a Reformed Convention statement on the environment. And number four, the best thing for it is it talks about engaging the whole congregation in this stuff. And there's a 5-part Bible study program.